From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, an update on David Big Papi Ortiz.
I feel real bad, like the insecure, like, and our country's really bad, and I feel bad for him. I hope he gets better.
Also today, from New Hampshire, 2020 contender Senator Amy Klobuchar on infrastructure, healthcare, and taking on Trump.
He loves chaos. He uses it to foment discord, and that's why we need a leader, and this is the leader that I can be and will be, who's going to look at governing in a very different way.
And what does the merger of Massachusetts-based Raytheon with United Technologies mean?
It becomes one big, fat, beautiful company. But I have to negotiate, meaning the United States has to buy things. And does that make it less competitive?
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're following news about retired Red Sox slugger David Ortiz, who was shot in his native Dominican Republic last night. At last report, he's in stable condition, but part of his colon has been removed. Ortiz also suffered injuries to his gallbladder and liver. The Sox will hold a news conference later this hour. We'll bring you updates as they come in. While we're waiting, we turn to our conversation with presidential candidate and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. She's campaigning in New Hampshire today, and we reached her shortly after an appearance at a Politics and Eggs breakfast at St. Anselm College. Klobuchar was speaking before business and political leaders there and laid out what she calls a progressive yet common sense agenda addressing health care, immigration, and the need for better infrastructure in states like New Hampshire.
We have to be able to respond to what we need. And what you need here, just like actually in my state, you need more workers to be able to come up and fill the jobs. You need to make it easier for people to come back and forth. You've got a great tourism industry here that could be even greater.
Senator, I was watching your appearance at Politics and Eggs this morning and was struck by something you said about infrastructure spending and the 2017 Trump tax cuts. You voted against that tax cut bill, but suggested this morning that you might have been able to vote yes if the corporate tax rate had not been lowered so significantly and if the bill had included infrastructure spending. So can you fill in some more details? I mean, what's a compromise that could have gotten you to support the tax cuts?
That bill was way off in so many ways, and I was just pointing out that the president lost an opportunity to actually get a bill passed that would have worked. And that could have involved some lowering of the corporate tax rate. I've made that clear for years that they could have been part of it. But he went way too far with that. The way they did the international tax return was totally off. We actually could get back $150 billion just by changing that. There were significant problems with the bill, with the way they structured a co-op provision. There were so many things wrong with the bill that you would want to start over. And that doesn't mean that there weren't some things you would include from that bill.
So for you to get to yes, it would have taken a lot to get you to yes.
Yes, that's what I want to make clear. However, I think it was widely believed, and I certainly believe this, that that is your opportunity, and there will be another one, to use a tax bill, to use that tax bill and the way some of the money was wasted to help finance infrastructure, because the corporate tax rate should not have gone that low to 21%. I think most companies, even those that were involved in lobbying on this, seemed to think at some point it was going to be around 25, 26%, and it went all the way down to 21%, and every point was $100 billion that could have been spent on transit in Massachusetts or a new commuter rail system in New Hampshire, or roads and bridges, or rural broadband. And that just didn't happen.
Are Democrats, though, missing an opportunity on infrastructure as well, Senator? I'm thinking of a recent White House meeting between Trump and Democratic leaders that was going to focus on infrastructure. But as you recall, that sort of blew up very quickly after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the president was guilty of a cover-up. I mean, is that kind of rhetoric that maybe, you know, stops Democrats from getting things done on infrastructure, too?
Well, I think we know there's all kinds of things going on in Washington right now. I looked at that meeting this way. On Donald Trump's election night, one of the top things he said he wanted to get done was infrastructure. And he has done absolutely nothing. We've been basically living off the FAST Act, which was a bill that was helpful, that passed, that I supported, that passed before he got there. And now nothing has happened. And for him to have called that meeting, and then when they said, okay, Mr. President, come back with some ideas and ways to finance it, like I've done with my trillion-dollar plan, by the way. I've been very clear, laid out every single penny and how it's going to work. And then when he came back, it turns out they already had that plan. We know that. The media knew it, where he was just going to basically walk out of there and say, oh, I don't like you guys because you're investigating me. Come on. To me, it was because he didn't want to move forward. He didn't have a way to pay for it except to take some of the money out of his tax bill that was so tilted toward the wealthy, and it's so obvious how we should pay for this, but he didn't want to do that, so then he storms out and tries to make a scene. So, I mean, that is just typical. It's what he did this last week on the tariffs, where he sort of sets up a mock situation and says, oh, I'm going to put this 5% tariff because I'm mad about immigration.
On Mexico.
And then, right, on exports. And then he comes around and says, no, 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 I've saved the day with a plan that we've later found out was already a plan before he did that. And I just think this makes a mockery of our politics and our government at a time when people are looking for trust and stability. They want to have a leader in the White House that says, you know, yeah, we have immigration issues at the border, but we also have immigration issues for our country. We don't have enough workers in some of our factories and our farmers. We want to have new ideas and new businesses. We should have comprehensive immigration reform. It reduces the debt by $158 billion in 10 years. That was the 2013 bill. And he could have done that. He could have been Nixon going to China when he first got elected, but he didn't do that. And so all of these issues that are right on our table right now, things like climate change and workforce training and immigration reform and doing something about our healthcare system and pharmaceutical prices, those are challenges that are hitting people right now in front of him. And instead, he chooses to basically rest on the laurels of this economy that has been stabilized by the good work of our businesses and our workers instead of meeting the challenges in front of him. He loves chaos. He uses it to foment discord and to help him with his base. It is really obvious, and that's why we need a leader, and this is the leader that I can be and will be, who's going to look at governing in a very different way. That is how you bring people together.
Let me ask you about some big recent news in the state where you're campaigning right now. So New Hampshire last month became the 21st state to abolish the death penalty. Minnesota did this way back in 1911, so catching up to Minnesota about a century later. You didn't have death penalty cases then when you were a county prosecutor. So let me ask you if New Hampshire made the right move in your view.
Yes, I am opposed to the death penalty. I look at it this way. First of all, as a former prosecutor, I always look at what helps reduce crime. But when you look at the states that have it, they don't have lower crime rates. In some cases, they have higher crime rates. I also look at money fiscally. It is very expensive. It is actually more expensive because of the appeals than having life without parole. And we have life without parole for very dangerous criminals, for very dangerous murders. The last thing I look at is how it has been racially discriminatory, that it has not been fairly used across the country. In any case, I do not support the death penalty. And I had this position when I was county attorney, and I have it today.
So one of your highest profile cases when you were a county attorney was against the Baseball Hall of Famer Kirby Puckett. I want to ask you about—
people don't always bring up that, especially when the Twins are having like the best season in over a decade. I just had to bring that in there for Red Sox fans.
Yeah, go Twins. Yeah, yeah. Well, we're sort of on the bubble here in Boston in the meantime.
I know. You've had some, let's just say you've had some good teams.
Yeah, hard to complain. And RBs, maybe we'll bring home another one.
Yeah, okay. But the Twins are owed this, man. They're the Cinderella team.
Let me ask you about this case, though. Let's go serious. Yeah, well, so you
char-
just for folks who don't remember, you charged him in 2002 with sexual assault for allegedly groping a woman in a bar. He was later acquitted. You wrote in your 2015 memoir that our prosecutors believed her account of what happened, the woman who had accused him. Do you still believe Puckett's accuser? And were you ahead of the Me Too movement when you decided to bring those charges?
Well, we have a job. When I was the chief prosecutor, our job was to evaluate the facts and the evidence and make a decision. And we had actually had some cases brought in that we hadn't charged with him that were not about bars or about that. It was other things involving his ex-wife. And we didn't think the case was there. But in this point, we did feel it was there. We knew it was going to be a very hard case because we only had one witness. And we charged it as a lower level offense, as it should have been. And what happened was it went to jury. We had a very experienced prosecutor on it. I think people felt that we did a really good job with the case. And we looked at this and we thought, look, if this wasn't against a famous person, I actually had them show me. I had our prosecutors show me cases that we had brought in similar circumstances. So we decided to charge it, knowing it was going to be a hard go. Beloved figure in Minnesota. I still remember the words that I said when we charged it. Like, for every Minnesotan, Kirby Puckett was my hero, but that day, that night in that bar, he was no one's hero, which was a true fact.
So was justice served, though, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
By bringing the case, yes, we did the right thing. We didn't win. I remember one of our claims to fame was that the jury was out longer than like OJ's and three other sports stars combined. And so I felt like justice was done because we did the right thing in bringing the case. The jury made their decision, but it was still the right thing to do. And the victim felt that way even after we lost, and we felt that way. And I think the community felt that way. And sometimes you just have to make hard decisions, even if they don't seem popular at the time.
So we've seen some voters give you credit for that case, for being willing to charge a powerful man with sexual assault. But as you know, the other side of your reputation as a tough prosecutor is some criticism for charging smaller offenses. You said when you were running in 1998, for example, that the broken windows theory is correct. And that was a theory popularized by Rudy Giuliani that cracking down on petty crime can curb serious crime. What's your current position on the broken windows theory?
Well, obviously, there have been abuses of that. I just want to make clear, we only had felony adult crimes, so we didn't have some of those crimes that were being prosecuted in New York in my jurisdiction. We did in the juvenile area, but in Minnesota, the juvenile system is, with the exception of serious crime, tends to give kids a second chance. So what I've learned over time is a much bigger emphasis I took as I went through my 8 years in that job on drug court, on trying to get people off of drugs, off of alcohol, that is a major contributing force when we look at our some of our petty crimes as well as our more serious crimes. And I'm a big believer in those. I led the effort in the Senate. The other thing I learned that anyone that is being honest that has a prosecutor job will tell you that there's racism in our system. And that while my state tends to have lower sentences for most crimes, like every other state, there were things that were not fair racially. So what are the answers there? Well, I worked hard to make our office in who we hired more reflective of the community, including people in leadership positions in my office and our management team. I worked hard to make sure that the way we had cases brought in was fair. I did this innovative work with the Innocence Project, doing eyewitness identifications a different way that would reduce racial misidentification, as well as we had videotaped interrogations. We were one of the first states that did that. And then the way we select grand juries. I mean, there's just so many things. And then, of course, sentencing. And that I've had a bigger opportunity to be involved in as a senator with the First Step Act, which I'm so glad that we finally got done on a bipartisan basis, which reduces federal drug sentences for people that are nonviolent offenders. They were pretty out of control at the high end, a lot of them. Stories like Josephina, this woman that Barack Obama ended up pardoning that served over a decade in prison when, in fact, she wasn't even someone who was doing drugs or actually selling them. She was a middle person. for someone else. And so anyway, I'm glad about that. And if I could just move forward of what we have to do. Body cameras, good idea.
Oh, and we were just rolling those out in Boston now, too. So it's very,
exactly.
Yeah, very top of mind.
And then the one other thing I would add is the Second Step Act, which will be creating incentives for states to do the same thing we did federally.
So you've been very busy on this front, but I guess I want to give you a chance to respond to some criticism that I know you have heard as well, which is that, you know, and granted, you inherited these racial disparities when you were a county attorney, but Nakima Levy Armstrong, who's the former president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP, recently told the Washington Post, talking about your tenure, she said, rather than taking steps to help mitigate some of those concerns and issues, during her tenure in office, your tenure, her policies exacerbated the situation. I mean, how do you respond to that?
I don't really see that in the numbers, because when you look at the numbers, there was actually a reduction during my tenure in African-American the prison sentences. It was a reduction that was somewhat significant. And I, like every other prosecutor, knows that we must change our system to do better. But I'd also like to point out that we also did a lot of good things with the community that I don't apologize for, that I'm proud of. And that is that when I got into that office, there were a number of gang murders of little kids, African-American kids, that had gone unprosecuted. And we took them on. One was a little boy named Byron Phillips, and he was murdered on the front steps of his porch. And that case had gone unsolved, actually. And I worked with the community, the African-American, predominantly African-American community, put up billboards, and with the police, we found the killer, and we prosecuted that case and put that guy behind bars. So during my time, we had many, many cases like that. And I made sure that we met the community's concerns, and I didn't just stay in my office. I went out there and met with them and worked with them, and we figured out ways to make sure that their neighborhoods were safer. And so the figure on the reduction in prison sentence was 12% during my time.
So I think one of the big concerns in a lot of communities right now is this opioid crisis. And I want to ask you a little bit about that. I know it's been at the forefront of your campaign, substance abuse, also mental health, which are sort of tied together. And I wonder if this is an area where you see a chance for some bipartisan compromise if you're president, because at least whenever there's a mass shooting, Republicans often are talking about mental health. And the president has certainly confronted or been talking a lot about the opioid crisis. Is this an area where you think you can get something done in Washington?
I do. And that's because you have seen glimmers of bipartisan work on this. The need is so huge. It doesn't matter if it's a blue state or a red state. 1 out of 5 people suffer from some kind of mental illness sometime in their life. That's a lot of Americans. 1 out of 2 have addiction in their family or someone they're close to, and that's alcohol or opioids. And we should not forget meth or cocaine, which tend to hit communities of color more than opioids. And so my solution is this. Let's just not talk about it. Let's put the money into it. And let's just not have it be only on opioids. My plan, $100 billion, paid for by the master settlement we're going to see coming out of those lawsuits against the pharma companies that were producing the opioids, conservative estimate, $40 billion, and then more money from a 2 cents per milligram fee on the opioids. And I get to $100 billion. What's the money used for? Well, first of all, mental health beds. We went from a state-based system to a community-based system for mental health. All good intentions, good reasons. But so many states don't have the beds. In Iowa right now, they only have 64 public mental health beds for the whole state. And so you see this in Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire as well. And then we are having a huge increase in suicides. 30% increase in suicides in America in 15-year period. Answer, more early intervention, more counselors in school, making sure that we're watching our military when they come home, and so we're keeping touch with them. You've got the bed issue on both the addiction and the mental health, and then, of course, you've got insurance coverage, mental health parity, something my mentor, Paul Wellstone, before he died in that plane crash, was his number one focus. We passed the bill, but we need to get it implemented, and I'd note that he worked with Ted Kennedy on this. We miss all the time in the Senate. And then Patrick Kennedy carried on the torch. So there's a big Massachusetts-Minnesota connection when it comes to this work in this mental health area.
Sure. And let me just ask one more while I've got you, Senator. I know your time is short, but a sort of related health care issue that goes with that is, as we would pay for these services in the future, would it be paid for under a Medicare for all style health care system, which is very popular within your party? You're not quite there yet. You said perhaps down the line.
I'm always open to looking at it. I want to get there sooner. I want to get to more coverage. So this is what I'd propose. I think people have the exact same goal, which is universal health care. And the way that I would get there is building on the Affordable Care Act. So the first thing you do is bring down the cost of premiums. I would start with cost-sharing reinsurance, something that has been working. Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire actually has a good bill on this, and do that immediately. Then a public option, something Barack Obama desperately wanted to do. And the way you do it is by making sure that you have a competitive option, a public option, and you can do it with Medicaid or you can do it with Medicare, but it bring the cost down because there's no middlemen insurance companies. And I think it's doable because people want to see some kind of option for them that costs less money. Then the big ticket item, since it's nearly 20% of health care, is pharmaceutical prices. Nothing has been done. Nothing was done in the Affordable Care Act, and nothing has been done since then to bring down the cost of pharmaceuticals. I am leading the bill, and I have been for a decade, to require Medicare to negotiate on behalf of America's 43 million seniors to bring down the drug prices. There is a ban on that negotiation. That would set a bar for the whole country when it comes to pharma. Stopping the horrendous practice where big pharma pays off generics to keep their products off the market. I know that these pharmaceutical companies are major American employers. I know there's a lot in Massachusetts that is an important part of the economy. But that doesn't mean that we can't get a more even playing field for consumers when it comes to pharmaceutical prices. That, mental health, making sure we keep a woman's right to choose strong, those would all be things that I would be focusing on when it comes to health care.
That's U.S. Senator from Minnesota and Democratic presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar. Senator, thanks for joining us from New Hampshire today.
Well, it's been great to be on. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, what does the merger of Raytheon and United Technologies mean for Massachusetts? I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Raytheon, the Waltham defense contractor, is merging with Connecticut neighbor United Technologies. The combined company will be headquartered in Greater Boston and become the country's second biggest in aerospace and defense. We're talking roughly $75 billion in annual sales, more than Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman, and second only to Boeing. So what does that mean for Massachusetts? Well, to help answer that question, we turn to Boston Globe business reporter John Chesto. Hey there, John.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. So listen, before we get to the impact of this deal on the state, let's start by just reminding listeners about these two companies and what they do, beginning with the local one, with Raytheon. You know, if you've heard of them, you probably know about them making missiles. But what else do they do? What's the profile of this company?
Well, they're very big into cybersecurity. They've got a large aerospace business in general, which I would include satellite technology. They are most of the revenue comes from the Department of Defense, and in that way, that they're different from United Technologies, which gets most of its revenue from other corporate clients.
Well, you say that they're different, but President Donald Trump says he's still worried about a possible impact on competition in defense spending. He called into CNBC's Squawk Box earlier today, and this is what he had to say.
When I hear they're merging, does that take away more competition? It becomes one big, fat, beautiful company. But I have to negotiate, meaning the United States has to buy things. And does that make it less competitive? Because it's so already very less. It's already non-competitive.
So, John, I mean, the company's response to the president is that they don't have a lot of overlapping products, and therefore this isn't going to reduce competition by merging. Can you referee this one?
Yeah, I guess I would have to agree with the companies here that they do sort of complementary work in the aerospace field. One thing that, though they are concerned about getting the Department of Defense to sign off, they're going to need to get the thumbs up from the Department of Defense. And it's interesting that they have sort of projected, you know, the $1 billion in annual savings that they say this merger is going to bring about after 4 years together. They're going to say they're going to give a lot of that savings back to the Department of Defense. So that tells me that they're sort of building a case to the Department of Defense to show, hey, this is going to be better for you, not worse.
You know, one other note, United Technologies' portfolio includes the company that makes those sensors that are really under scrutiny right now after two deadly crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX airplanes. Does that have anything to do with this deal, John? Do you see any impact on that?
You know, that's interesting. I've talked to a few analysts, and I've read a ton of their reports today, and that one hasn't come up. But there is sort of this undercurrent of, are they doing this deal to kind of gloss over problems that we're not seeing in one or both of the companies, or problems that we know about but we don't know how big they are? So that could be one of them. I think, you know, the company is obviously stronger together than apart in terms of just size and revenue, and UTC is going to be much smaller once it spins off its carrier buildings division and its Otis elevator division. So I think there may be some truth to that. I find it hard to believe that that's, you know, why they're pulling the trigger on a merger to kind of paper over problems. But there may be some benefit that the company's not copying to right now.
Those Otis and you mentioned those Otis and carrier spinoffs. Those were planned before this merger. But do you expect any other spinoffs might follow out of this deal?
No, I mean, the UTC, I mean, they might need to sell some small pieces to get antitrust clearance, I'm not sure, but no big spinoffs. I mean, UTC is going to be much smaller once they spin off Carrier and Otis. And it's interesting to note that it is those spinoffs, when they're announced, is what prompted Raytheon CEO Tom Kennedy to reach out to Greg Hayes, the CEO of United Technologies, last summer and start talking about, hey, maybe we should do a deal. You know, Raytheon wouldn't really want a company with elevators and air conditioners, but now that the company is much more aligned just in the aerospace defense business, it makes more sense for Raytheon to team up.
John, let me ask you about some other recent Raytheon news. You know, the Trump administration just last week approved a controversial arms deal that allows high-tech bomb parts to be manufactured in Saudi Arabia, and the company that's going to do the co-production of those parts is Raytheon. So what is the level of concern there about actually building these bomb parts in Saudi Arabia?
You know, it's interesting. Raytheon has taken some heat for its business in Saudi Arabia, most noticeably with the big Davos in the Desert controversy, where they, you know, were sponsors, or, you know, they're sending people over. I mean, it's still a small piece of the overall Raytheon business, so I see it more as, you know, maybe a political liability and one that may pop up during the review of this. But I, you know, the Trump administration doesn't seem overly concerned, and so therefore, I don't see it becoming a big issue. Perhaps people in Congress might make an issue of it.
So this merged company will be known as Raytheon Technologies. And as we said, it's going to be based somewhere in greater Boston. John, do we know anything about what the state might have offered to entice that company to choose Massachusetts and not go to Connecticut, where UTC is based?
Now, I've checked to see if there's any sort of discussions. I have not gotten a definitive answer, you know, in terms of state level, if there have been. But my sense is there have not, that this surprised the Baker administration as much as it surprised us. I think what the two biggest reasons they would be coming here, number one is talent. You know, the cluster of smart people here is, you know, been already well documented. And, of course, the universities in the area. And maybe I don't know this to be true, but maybe the tax policy is encouraging them to come here as well. Tax policy for businesses and for wealthy individuals is still much better in Massachusetts than it is in Connecticut.
So what's the business impact then of having an even larger defense contractor in our region now, John? I mean, we already have had Raytheon in Waltham for years, but this is going to be an even larger footprint.
I think we'll see a few, you know, maybe 100 or 200 jobs come. I think that's kind of small compared to the size of our economy. I think it's more of a black mark for Connecticut's reputation. Connecticut's obviously lost GE. It's lost Alexion, nearly lost Aetna. Connecticut really can't afford to have these negative business headlines. For us, you know, we have new companies coming here all the time. I think that perhaps that'll mean more money in philanthropic work in the area, and perhaps we might see more executives playing a bigger role in civic affairs here in Boston, depending on how the headquarters of the new combined company shapes up.
That's Boston Globe business reporter John Chesto. John, thanks for your time today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
One in five Massachusetts residents has experienced a medical error in the past 5 years. That's one of the key findings of a study out today from the Betsy Lehman Center for Patient Safety, a state agency that conducts research and training in medicine. The study finds the excess cost of medical errors in just 1 year is more than $600 million, and that's a conservative estimate. The researchers used insurance data to track preventable errors like infections after surgery, excess blood loss, and bed sores. To put these findings in context, we spoke with a couple of people, a hospital administrator and a doctor. Dr. Marianne Bomba is the president of the Massachusetts Medical Society, and Kim Holland is the president and CEO of Signature Healthcare, which manages Brockton Hospital. He's also the chair of the Mass Health and Hospital Association's Clinical Issues Advisory Council. This new study notes that there are errors in 115 of every 1,000 hospitalizations in the U.S. So I asked Kim Holland why errors remain so pervasive in Massachusetts and across the country?
It's a great question. Some would say that the human error rate, just we as humans doing something that we've done a lot, a number of times, our error rate is 1 in 1,000. Think of just in a hospital the number of medications we deliver in a day. It is in the thousands. So one of the problems, I think, embedded in errors or mistakes or complications is the fact that healthcare is a one-on-one personal relationship delivery system that is human-based. It is very difficult to error-proof it 100% because humans are interacting in a very complex environment, prone to make mistakes because humans will make mistakes if we do something enough times. And I think that's one of the sort of embedded problems in error prevention in healthcare.
Well, then, Kim, if I may ask, I mean, I take that point, and yeah, obviously, the human error is inevitable in any field. So, what in your mind might be an acceptable error rate?
I can't come up with a reasonable standard. I think we have to, in healthcare and leadership in healthcare, be driving towards zero errors and zero harm. The second we say there's an acceptable error rate, something less than zero, we start tolerating errors, not knowing whether that error was one that was acceptable or not. And I think we have to be aiming at zero harm and zero errors in healthcare.
So, Dr. Bomba, one of the other things I want to ask you about is the patient experience side of this. You know, so there's sort of two parts to this latest research. One is sort of documenting the scope of errors, but the other is how patients react to it. And this is something that stood out to me. So these researchers found that in more than half of the survey respondents who had a medical error 3 to 6 years ago, so this is some time has elapsed now, more than half of those people say that they always or sometimes continue to avoid doctors or the healthcare facility involved in the error. So there's a breakdown of trust there, Dr. Bamba, which may or may not be reasonable. How do we address that? I mean, how do we restore trust so that, you know, patients aren't avoiding subsequent care that they maybe need?
Communication is absolutely essential. Perhaps we're not as skilled in being able to communicate bad news or errors or complications when they occur as well as we do better news. And that this is certainly something that we need to improve upon going forward.
Yeah, it's a sticky issue, right, Kim Holland? Because as we talk about communication after there is a medical error, you know, one of the findings in the survey here by the Lehman Center is that, you know, a lot of patients said, look, I would feel better if a doctor was just up front and said, you know, I made a good faith mistake and here's how we're going to address it. But for you as a hospital administrator, I mean, is that something you want? I mean, would you want doctors just acknowledging, yeah, I screwed up? Because don't you open yourself up to lawsuits then all of a sudden?
You do open yourself up to lawsuits, but I'd much rather physicians as well as other clinicians admit when we could have done a better job and to be upfront and direct with patients. And the research shows actually just the opposite, that when we apologize to patients, malpractice suits actually go down.
Because patients feel like they're not being gaslighted and they're less likely to be angry and sue, you're saying?
Absolutely. And I think sometimes patients will believe that physicians and healthcare providers really didn't make a mistake intentionally. I think patients understand that and appreciate it when we acknowledge them and say that we need to change our processes and do better.
Kim, you said earlier that there isn't, it's hard to put a number on what an acceptable error rate would be. And I wonder if maybe there's a different way that you could kind of gauge it. I'm remembering an interview that you did with the Brockton Enterprise when you first took this job in 2010. And the editorial board of that newspaper asked you, you know, if you would, you and your family would seek your own medical treatment at Brockton Hospital, you know, sort of as a show of faith in the hospital that you oversee. And you said, yes, I'm going to do that. And I'm thinking then of a more recent report we just saw in the New York Times last week that was really sort of explosive because they had these secret recordings of doctors, cardiologists at a hospital in North Carolina acknowledging that they would not be willing to take their own family members for heart treatment at this hospital. I mean, is that maybe a standard that you can use? I mean, if you as a doctor wouldn't be willing to refer your own family to your hospital, maybe that's the problem.
Oh, if you are an insider in an organization and not willing to use your own organization, I think you have an obligation to try to improve that organization. You know, physicians have tremendous power, I believe, in our industry and should use it for good and should use it for positive change in their organizations.
Dr. Bamba, I'm remembering another story from probably 12 years ago by now about the checklist particularly in surgery. This was written by Dr. Atul Gawande, and the way he put it was that, you know, if there was a drug that was as effective as a checklist at improving healthcare, that, you know, we'd be just hailing this drug as a major breakthrough. I mean, is that something you see more and more, just sort of like almost like a flight checklist before surgeries in hospitals? And are there other similar procedures that we can put in place to reduce errors?
Absolutely, and I'm familiar with the checklist. That is one tool, but how do we design systems of care that are safe? And that will mean not just in my office, but when patients are then sent to the hospital, and then when patients are discharged from a hospital to go to a skilled nursing facility, this continuum of care, Cal, is what is very, very important to be able to design a framework for safety around, and hopefully building on the checklist, we will be able to go forward with a framework for safety that can be embraced across our care system.
So what should patients take away from this latest research by the Lehman Center, Dr. Bamba? I mean, we're holding institutions accountable. That's you know, what we should be doing. But I also don't want to lose sight of the fact that we do have world-class, you know, medical institutions and doctors doing great work every day here in Massachusetts. So we don't want to overstate the risk either. So what would your takeaway message be for patients?
For patients, I would ask them to partner with us in their care where they can, to not be afraid to ask questions, and likewise we should never be afraid to be asked a question or to have our plan of care, what we're doing, to be questioned. We want to partner with our patients. We want that openness. We want that communication to be there. It has to be there.
And Kim, what about you? Your takeaway message for patients? I mean, is it, you know, don't freak out, but also, you know, remember that, you know, your doctor is not God, and so you should reasonably push back and ask questions.
I think you really should ask questions, and patients, I believe, do have a role in their health care. One of the ways we make mistakes is human biases around comprehension, around thinking biases. And one of the things we're teaching our physicians at our hospital to ask in handoffs are four questions. And I think the four questions might equally be good questions for patients to ask their physicians as they engage and ask questions. And they are, what else could it be? What can't we miss? What doesn't fit the picture? And who else should be engaged? I think they're great questions that are fair for patients to ask their physicians.
Checklist for patients as well. That's Kim Holland. He's the president and CEO of Signature Healthcare. Kim, thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome.
Also, our thanks to Dr. Marianne Bamba. She's the president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. Dr. Bamba, thanks for coming.
Thank you so much, Cal.
Stay with us. We'll have the latest on David Ortiz next. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Let's turn now to the latest on retired Red Sox slugger David Ortiz. He was shot last night while at a bar in his native Dominican Republic. Red Sox president and CEO Sam Kennedy spoke about Ortiz at a news conference just moments ago.
Our medical team here in Boston and the doctors in the Dominican Republic have confirmed that David's condition is still serious, but that he is stable enough to be transported back here to Boston for continued care.
WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer is following the story and joins me now in the studio. Hey there, Shira.
Hey, Cal.
So that's some good news out of Sam Kennedy just moments ago, that Big Papi is stable enough to return to Boston. What else do we know about his current status?
It is good news, and we know that an air ambulance has been sent down to the Dominican Republic to transport David Ortiz back to Boston, where he will receive care at Massachusetts General Hospital.
We've heard some physicians telling the Boston Globe and other news outlets that this is the kind of injury that could be life-threatening. So this was really serious stuff, right? And he seems to be making some progress, but perhaps not out of the woods just yet.
Yeah. I mean, he was shot in the lower back and abdomen. He underwent 6 hours of surgery.
Wow.
And in the course of that surgery, he had part of his intestines removed, his gallbladder removed, his colon removed, we are told. Has been reported. He also suffered liver damage. So all of these are very concerning developments or reports about his medical condition.
Let's hear a little bit more from Sam Kennedy at that news conference. He expressed a lot of gratitude to the Red Sox fan base for all of their support throughout this ordeal.
I want to thank our fans, our players, Red Sox alumni, and the entire Red Sox community for the outpouring of support they've shown for David and David's family. Please know that we are doing everything we can to support David and his family during this very difficult period.
So, Shira, I mean, I think what that speaks to is just how beloved David Ortiz is as a figure, both in his native country, the Dominican Republic, and here in Boston, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want, you know, often use the word iconic, but I think iconic fits here for David Ortiz. I mean, this is a guy who won 3 World Series titles with the Red Sox, but more than that, he had this exuberant outside personality. He embraced the city, the city's passion for baseball. He's a gregarious guy who loves to be out and among the people. And that's sort of where he was last night, out at a bar in his hometown of Santo Domingo, you know, in the Dominican Republic, having a good time, enjoying some time with friends. And, you know, then this happens. And because he's so beloved, his father has said he doesn't know anyone who would want to shoot his son. And investigators are now in the process in the Dominican of trying to figure out what the motive was. If you watch the video of the shooting, it was, you know, it was done at very close range, some might say point blank range. He was ambushed, shot from behind by a man who jumped off of a motorcycle, shot him, and then tried to get away, but then was sort of captured, I guess is the way you describe it, by a crowd at the bar and beaten.
As I guess you'd expect from very angry fans in a country that absolutely loves this
guy,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, to the whole point about, like, it's hard to imagine why anybody would do this. I mean, Sam Kennedy, the Red Sox president, really talked about this, the role that he has in this community in Boston as well.
It's hard to express what David Ortiz means to the Boston Red Sox. When you love someone and they come in harm's way, it's jarring.
We've also heard some local fans responding to this, too. Our Simone Rios was out in Boston today talking to fans. One of the folks he ran into is a gentleman named Miguel Zapata, who owns a barbershop in Dorchester. This was his reaction.
I feel real bad, like, the insecure, like, and our country's really bad. And I feel bad for him. I hope he get better.
So there you hear it, Chair. I mean, from a fan, from the Red Sox president, Big Poppy's place in this community is really just – it's hard to overstate, isn't it?
Yeah, and we haven't even mentioned yet what he did in 2013 in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombings. I think that's when he really solidified his place as an icon in this city, when he said famously, this is, you know, our bleeping city. And, you know, it was just a show of strength and a show of defiance in the face of the bombings that has never been forgotten and really endeared him to this community even more in some ways than the titles he won with the Red Sox.
Well, and as he prepares to get on a plane back to Boston for medical treatment, we're mindful that he was planning to come back to Boston this week anyway for a charity event on Wednesday, because that's just
because that's who he is.
That's who he was, right? Yeah, it's just in keeping with him. What about the shooter, Ishier? He's been identified as 25-year-old Eddie Feliz Garcia. Do we know anything about him or his motive, or does this just seem to come out of the blue?
It seemed to come out of the blue. Still under investigation. You know, different reports have trickled out. It's hard to tell what's credible, what's not. And as Sam Kennedy actually said during the press conference, you know, not only with the medical information, but they're holding back on, you know, any speculation about anything. It's been difficult to get information out of the Dominican Republic. So I think at this point, letting authorities determine what the motive might have been, you know, why David Ortiz, was David Ortiz even the intended target? That all has to be sorted out. I do know that authorities had to wait for a period of time before they could question the gunman because he was beaten so badly by the crowd at the bar.
So let me ask you, I mean, this episode calls to mind something I know that you covered almost a couple of decades ago. I'm thinking of the stabbing of a Celtic star, Paul Pierce, outside of a bar in 2000.
Inside of a bar in Boston. You know, I mean, I think, and that's, you know, we kind of tend to think, oh, this happened in the Dominican Republic. You know, we also hear not infrequently about players being kidnapped in South America, baseball players or their family members being kidnapped and held for ransom.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so obviously in a country like the Dominican Republic and some South American countries, players, because of their wealth, are targets, their wealth and fame. But it's you know, you're not immune to it anywhere. And that was true of the Paul Pierce incident. And I think it just underscores, you know, the athlete celebrity culture and how it can attract, you know, it attracts fame, it attracts fans, but it also attracts, you know, people who might shoot you in a bar in the Dominican Republic or might stab you in a club in Boston.
Yeah. Well, Shira, I know you'll keep following the story, and our WBUR team will continue to deliver the latest. In fact, we'll have more updates about Big Poppy's status on All Things Considered at 4 o'clock. But Shira, while I have you, I do want to ask you about some brighter news in the Boston sports world. We did have Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final last night. It was a must-win for our Bruins, and they did indeed extend it Game 7. It was close for a while.
But I mean, you really did sense, though, in this game, as soon as Marchand scored on that, you know, 5-on-3 power play, that the Bruins were of a different mindset. They were chasing down pucks. They were more aggressive than I'd seen them in previous games. I mean, hungrier in some ways. There was the sense even from the first period that this was going to go the Bruins' way.
Yeah, so the final is 5-1, which sounds like it was kind of a blowout.
Yes.
But earlier, the game was tight. And I do want to highlight one of the key plays here. So with the Bruins up by a single goal.
Oh, is this the Mac? Is it?
I'm going with this, right?
It may be the play of the year.
It might be. So just to set this up, Tuukka Rask, who made 28 saves,
yes.
may have been overshadowed by the best save of the night by Charlie McAvoy, one of his defensemen. So the puck hits the post, bounces into Tuukka Rask's
back. Off of Tuukka Rask's back.
It's behind him.
Yeah, he has no concept of where the puck is.
Yeah, and then Charlie McAvoy, with amazing hand-eye coordination, swats it out of the way, and then here's what Tuukka said after the game about this great play by his defenseman.
Chucky hit it with his stick, and I kind of heard it. I didn't know where it was, and I figured it might be, somewhere behind my back. It's never a good thing for a goalie to kind of be facing the play with your back, but, luckily it stayed out.
I mean, it was pretty amazing. I have watched this several times in slow motion, and I still can't locate the puck before Charlie McAvoy literally bats it out of the goal mouth. I mean, it is mind-boggling when you look. It's like, how did he pick that up? Where was it? Where did it go? I mean, and I think it's important to say that you mentioned it was close early on. As
yeah.
much as I have said that the Bruins clearly seem to have momentum in their favor and to be in control of the game, If they had scored on that goal, this was midway through the second period, it would have tied the game 1-1 and completely changed the tenor of the game, because then the crowd at the Enterprise Center is back in it, and you're potentially going into the third period even, instead of going to the third period ahead.
But instead, the Bruins pull away, and at the end, Zdeno Chara nets an empty netter, which is great because he's been playing with that big face mask on. So here we go to Game 7, and the seconds that we have left, Chara, how do we look? Are we going to have a duck boat parade later next week?
I think there's a very good chance. I mean, it's always tough to make predictions, but this is the prediction I will make. Tuukka Rask will come up big once again in goal and is going to be an incredibly physical game. It has been a physical series. The Blues like to play physical hockey, but it's going to be ratcheted up even more in Game 7.
All right. That's WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And again, we'll have more on David Ortiz in the 4 o'clock hour as Alex Cora takes the microphone. The Red Sox manager will be hearing from him and have more updates on All Things Considered. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.